Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Walt Smittinger. I'm here on behalf of Patricia Boone in her workers' compensation claim. This does represent an appeal from the Industrial Accident Board through the Superior Court here. And the issue really comes down to one of access to medical care in the workers' compensation context. It has been characterized below as a matter of discretion. We believe it's a matter of statutory construction and that we're really dealing with a legal error below in terms of how these statutes should be construed.
So that means de novo review?
I believe so. Your Honor, 2322 of Title 19 is the statute that enables or obligates the carrier and employer to provide medical care to injured workers. The first subsection of that statute...
Mr. Spittinger, before we get into the substance of your argument, I just wanted to ask you a question that goes to really what is at stake here. I mean, it looks as though it's the difference between what it would cost the employer to pay for the drug the employee here would pay for the drug. I mean, is that a lot of money, or is just a battle of principle?
It's not a battle of principle, sir. The issue in this particular case, reduced to dollars, amounts to the difference, the lower amount that the carrier wants to pay for this prescription, as opposed to what the fee schedule defines as a reasonable cost for this prescription. That's not really the problem in this case. The problem in this case is access to those prescriptions at all, because the board's decision says you have to use the carrier's provider. Okay. And if any prescription dispensed by the carrier's provider is subject to the carrier's authorization, which may be withheld for any reason or no reason. And if it is, the claimant has to file a petition and go to the board to get the controversy resolved.
Now,
that's a six-month
The carrier's thing. Provider here, Express Scripts, is basically what? That's a service with pharmacies all over Delaware?
I would characterize it as a contractual arrangement, sort of a back-end pharmacy that has arrangements with brick-and-mortar pharmacies in the area. They also have a mail-order pharmacy facility so that they can ship prescriptions. The problem is that regardless of where the claimant accesses that supplier, think of it as a distributor, perhaps, because it's sort of higher up the chain. Wherever the claimant accesses that provider, whether it's at the local CVS, Target, Walmart, or through a mail-order pharmacy, the authorization all goes to that central point. And if the authorization doesn't exist, if the carrier refuses to authorize any prescription, it doesn't happen, regardless of what location the claimant might be at.
Is that a real problem or a theoretical one?
It's a real problem.
Does the record reflect how it was a problem for your client?
It wasn't a problem yet at the time of the hearing, because at the time of the hearing, the claimant was sourcing medications from a pharmacy provider of her own choosing, one that does not require that authorization. And therein lies the problem. When you limit the claimant to only the carrier's chosen provider and no authorization happens, then the claimant's deprived of access and it requires litigation and six-month wait.
But we actually haven't had a situation documented in the record where authorization was denied. Is that correct?
That is true in this case.
Well, let me just explore for a moment and follow up on the Chief Justice's question, the mechanics of how access might be denied.
Sure.
This may disqualify me, but I happen to use Express Scripts privately. And the way it works is, you get your physician issues a prescription and notifies Express Scripts. Express Scripts sends a prescription. Usually there are several refills. To the extent that you want to do a refill, you call Express Scripts directly and they ship. Now, there may be a delay in getting it shipped, but there's no problem of access. Now, but the gatekeeper is the private physician. How does it work?
I would actually disagree that the gatekeeper is the private physician when we go to the workers' compensation context, because
right.
Express Scripts, in your example, Express Scripts isn't looking to the doctor to tell the Express Scripts is not looking to the doctor to say, yes, the bill will be paid, go ahead and dispense the prescription. That's also true in the workers' compensation case. In your example, Express Scripts is looking to your private health insurance.
Correct.
That has no reason to deny and is going to go ahead and authorize whatever your routine prescriptions are. Okay.
But isn't the employer in this case also subcontracting this out to a private health carrier? I mean, is there really any difference here?
The difference, yes, there's a difference. The difference is that the workers' compensation carrier has a relationship with Express Scripts, and they've represented that as for cost containment. They want to pay less for prescriptions. But Express Scripts is still looking to workers' compensation for the authorization. Yes, go ahead and dispense this prescription. We're going to pay for it. And the dispensing doesn't happen without that authorization. So it's not simply a matter of the claimant having a prescription and everything is okay.
But, I mean, this is also true in the private context. The authorization comes from the insurer.
I would suggest that the motivations are substantially different. Blue Cross doesn't have an incentive to deny my prescriptions because it's a general health insurance policy. Workers' comp may elect to contest compensability, may elect to contest whether a particular claimant should still be on these medications.
Okay. So there, you're saying there's a built-in conflict.
Absolutely.
But to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, that this on this record it's theoretical, no, there's no evidence of any actual denial based on that conflict.
At the time of the hearing, it hadn't yet been ordered. I would have to go off the record to tell you that it happens in other cases, but it happens in other cases. It will be back here.
The prescription here, it was filled by your client's doctor?
My client's doctor has a pharmacy within his, there are several operations that go on at that particular office. There's a physical therapy facility, they have a massage practitioner, chiropractor as well, and they also provide pharmacy services there. It's an independent licensed entity within that umbrella group.
Okay, so you're not arguing that this is a medical service?
I'm not arguing that the doctor, it's a pharmacy. I mean, it would be unfair to characterize it as anything else. It's a pharmacy. It happens to run under the umbrella of the doctor's business.
Okay.
I do understand the court's concern about whether this is theoretical or not. The practical effect of this, it has broad ramifications. It is a matter of access to prescriptions. We're dealing with, in this case, prescriptions including narcotics. In other cases, we can frequently be dealing with things like antidepressants, which are used in a chronic pain context. A number of these medications, you can't simply stop without substantial medical consequences. They have serious side effects. They're powerful medications. And abruptly discontinuing them can, in some cases, land people in the hospital. This is not something that in a medical sense, is particularly safe.
Aren't there remedies for that before the board?
Yes, but they take 6 months. And that's the problem. If today my client calls me and says, I went to the pharmacy, I couldn't get my prescription, they wouldn't authorize it, my only option, my only tool at that point is to file a petition with the Industrial Accident Board and have them schedule a hearing.
But that can happen whether or not there's Express Scripts, right?
That can't, well, yes and no. And this gets to why the claimant's choice of access is important. This pharmacy that my client uses, and there are others too, like Injured Workers Pharmacy and Summit Pharmacy, that their business model is premised on, we're going to serve the workers' compensation market, and we're not going to ask for authorization. We're not going to demand that before we'll dispense prescriptions. They're taking a business risk, admittedly, but that's their business model. They're expecting that enough of these will go and be successful that they'll be able to make a business of it. But that enables, that's why it's important for the claimant to be able to use a provider of her choosing that can actually dispense these medications, can provide them. Many of them are quite expensive. It's one thing to have a routine medication that may be, you know, $20 or $30 for a month's refill. It's another to have medications that are in thousands of dollars a month. And for injured workers who may be out of work and receiving limited benefits, that's it might as well be $1 million a month. That's just not an option.
Well, you said the only remedy would be to file a petition for the board, and you can't even do that unless 6 months have passed. There's the other self-help remedy, which is to buy the medication privately and then in seek reimbursement from the comp carrier or the employer.
It's depending on the medication, it may not be a realistic option. And when we have a system here that says the employer is supposed to provide these medications, and when in a case like this, nobody's saying that these are the wrong, nobody's even contesting the
medication. Why is it not a realistic option?
If the medications are in the thousands of dollars a month, you can't pay out of pocket. But
this is beginning to sound like a declaratory judgment action. Do you have a record that shows the only alternative your client has is to pay an inordinate amount of money for the medications if they're not approved through the carrier and Express Scripts?
The medication costs were a matter of record before the Industrial Accident Board because the employer made an effort. My client, the hearing
okay,
before
well,
the
let's,
board.
Okay, well, let's stop there.
Okay.
They were a matter of record. You've posited to us it could be thousands of dollars. Does the record reflect your client faces the impossibility of getting her medication out of her own pocket and being reimbursed on a later date after the quarrel over the authorization is resolved?
The hearing that we had before the Industrial Accident Board was a legal hearing at which no evidence or testimony was permitted. So we didn't ultimately get to the opportunity for my client to say, I could afford $20 a month but not $50, and this is what my medication
so the
is.
Answer,
let me ask the question again. Do you have a record that establishes, in this case, thousands of dollars would be the difference, an impossibility to pay absent the authorization?
I do not have those numbers at hand. The only thing I could tell you is that you could potentially extrapolate from the numbers that are in the record in terms of what these medications cost as to how what they would be over 6 months. But I can't tell you that's thousands of dollars as I stand here.
Okay, what's the statutory mandate that you believe applies that requires us to accept your proposition?
The 2322 subsection A says that the claimant has the right to refuse to allow the employer to furnish these medications or other medical services. And it's our position that she has the right to procure them on her own.
Well, to be accurate, the statute doesn't really literally include medications. It talks about services, doesn't it? I mean, the issue here is whether medications are somehow encompassed by the language of the statute.
2322A does, in fact, specify medicines, sir.
But 2323 does not say you have the right to select your own pharmacy.
That's true, Your Honor. I would also say that 2323 also doesn't say that you have the right to select your own physical therapist. I'm not sure that's a distinction that should really be drawn under the policy of the Workers' Compensation Act.
Well, one of your problems is that the statute does distinguish between drugs or pharmacies and health providers. And the statute that you're relying on doesn't refer explicitly to pharmacies or even drugs.
Well, the statute that I'm referring to is 2322 subsection A. During the period of disability, the employer shall furnish reasonable surgical, medical, dental, optometric, chiropractic, and hospital services, medicine, and supplies, including repairing, and so on and so on.
And does that statute go on and say, and the employee may refuse?
Yes, sir. That's the concluding clause, unless the employee refuses to allow them to be furnished by the employer. The necessary implication of that is that the claimant has the right to access those necessary treatments to address the work-related injury on her own and recoup those expenses within the constraints of the fee schedule.
Why does 2323 exist then? Why is it needed?
Legislatively, 2322 existed earlier than the present 2323. I think that 2323 clarifies and makes express what's implicit. I think it's expressed in 2322 that the claimant may refuse that the employer supply these. 2323 makes it express that the claimant can choose, but more importantly, that statute goes on to say you have to give notice to the employer so they know you're actually treating, they know you're actually using a doctor before that you can put those bills to the employer for payment once the carrier's responsibility for the claim is determined.
Does 2353A come into play?
2353?
Yeah. It says if the employee refuses reasonable surgical, medical, and hospital services, medicines, and supplies tendered to the employee by the claimant's employer. The claimant forfeits all right to compensation for any injury or any increase in the claimant's incapacity shown to have resulted from such refusal.
The forfeiture statute, Your Honor, I believe really is intended to address if the claimant refuses to help himself get better. And that's an important goal, certainly. If your condition is made worse by the fact that you decline reasonable treatment, that's a problem that the system intends to address with that statute. I don't think that you can, if you have to read the statute as a whole, as we do, I don't think that you can reconcile the forfeiture statute while still giving meaning to this phrase in 2322A that allows the claimant to refuse that the employer provide medications, treatment, and supplies.
Well, why isn't the logical combination of these statutes that if the employee, for her convenience, or the claimant, for her convenience, declines to accept the employer's proffered equivalency opportunity to purchase medicines, then she forfeits the right beyond that and just has to pay for her own?
I don't think that that's what's intended by the legislature when the cost of workers' compensation claims is intended to be put on the industry creating them.
No.
And the fact that we have a fee schedule that constrains the costs. I mean, the very concern that you address is it shouldn't be unreasonably expensive to do this. And we've imposed a fee schedule to define what's reasonable in terms of these expenses, which obviates a lot of the concern about whether the claimant is sourcing medications or treatment or otherwise with someone other than the employer's preferred provider.
We're in your rebuttal time, and I hate to take more of it, but what about the situation where the employee wants Lipitor and the employer says, no, you get the generic equivalent because it's cheaper? Is this the kind of denial of an authorization that we're talking about here?
No, it's not. Because first of all, that's a question of medical necessity that I think the board would have to answer. Is it equivalent? Is this okay? Can we use an alternate medication? I would also say that there is a formulary in the regulations that specifies a preference for generics, for example. Mm-hmm. But those are questions that I think that the board would need to answer. This is a case where...
And that's not the kind of issue we have here.
No, everybody says this medication is appropriate for her. We just don't want you using this pharmacy.
Okay. You want to save the balance of your time?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, it's a pleasure to be here. May it please the Court, my name is John Klusman, and I represent the appellee in this case, SIAB Services. As Mr. Smittinger has told you, we're here because his client wants to use Dr. Ballou's office to prescribe prescriptions rather than Express Scripts, which is a program that my client is a part of. Just so you know exactly what we're talking about, and it sounds like Justice Jacobs certainly does, with the claimant gets a prescription card. With that prescription card, he or she can go to virtually any pharmacy in the area, can go to virtually any grocery store in the area, can go to stores like Costco or Walmart, can even take the option of having those prescriptions sent right to the claimant's house, right to the plaintiff's house. Right to the employee's house in this case. It's the same dosage. It's the same brand name. It's the same number of pills. Everything is the same, but the cost. The cost is less with Express Scripts. What we're asking is not unreasonable, and what we're asking is certainly compatible with the statute. Mr. Schmittinger seems to be saying that employees have an absolute right to deny anything that's offered by the employer as far as medical treatment or medical care and go out and get it on their own, even if it's at a greater price. And I don't think that's what the statute says. The statute only gives employees the rights that are specifically laid out in the language of the statute.
And those rights are?
Well, those rights are Section 2323. That's the section that Justice Ridgely commented on, and it's the section that gives the absolute rights to the claimant, in my opinion. It tells the employee that they have the right to a physician, a surgeon, a dentist, an optometrist, or a chiropractor of their own choosing.
Does that mean that the physical therapist could be selected by the employer?
I think it does. That's a natural extension of my argument, Justice Ridgely, and I think it's explained in my following comments, because no two doctors are alike. The claimant may perceive Dr. A gives better service than Dr. B for whatever reason. So the claimant can choose Dr. A for treatment if they want to do that.
Okay, so 2323 is a right of choice statute.
Yes, sir.
But it encompasses physicians and medical services, but not drugs.
Correct.
And to the extent a different section allows an employee to decline drugs that are offered to be furnished by the employer, the consequence of that is forfeiture, not the right to choose some other provider.
That's exactly right. It's forfeiture under Section 2353, and that's what Justice
Sealy. What's the remedy of an injured worker, say, lives in Claymont, and the employer says, you're going to use our pharmacy in Georgetown, you're going to use our physical therapist in Georgetown?
Well, that is, we are responsible for furnishing medical care to the claimant, reasonable medical care. Furnishing has been said to be whatever it takes to bring the claimant and the treatment together. So I don't think the Industrial Accident Board would allow me as an employer to say, you claimant have to travel an unreasonable distance to get medications or an unreasonable distance to get physical therapy. It just wouldn't happen. The board wouldn't allow it.
And their authority is basically under the word reasonable to do that?
I think they have wide latitude, yes, to make sure that the claimant is afforded the medical care that their physicians say they need. So, yes, I think they would probably rely on the word reasonable to do that.
Mr. Cosman, when you began your presentation, you said everything is the same under either regime, except the cost of the drug.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Schmittinger says, no, there's one other difference, and that's the difference that he claims drives this dispute, mm-hmm. and that is there's a built-in conflict of interest between the carrier, the workers' comp carrier, and the employee, and that because of that built-in conflict, the carrier has a dollar incentive to decline prescribing medication, although there's no record that has happened here or any other time. Right. Is that a risk?
I don't see it as a risk, Your Honor. I think that if as in your case, your prescriptions get denied under Express Scripts, that denial, it goes through your health carrier. If it's denied, it's for a reason that the health carrier doesn't think those prescriptions are reasonable anymore for some reason, probably something that's in your medical records. By the same token, if the carrier, the worker comp carrier...
But the argument here, just if I can interrupt, mm-hmm. is that in my case, or the case of any non-workers comp case, there's no built-in incentive to try to shortchange the patient, but there is here. And all I'm asking is that a real risk?
I don't see that as a risk, Your Honor. I think I'm smirking a little bit, but it sounds a little cynical to me to say that there is an incentive for the carrier to kind of shortchange a claimant. I don't think that is a realistic assessment of what workers' compensation carriers do.
Well, for both. The private situation, and I use that term to mean the non-comp situation and the comp situation, there's certainly an incentive for whoever's paying the bill to pay the least amount possible.
Yes, sir.
And apart from a medical record that says somebody has prescribed digitalis for a superficial flesh wound, and they see that in the record, what would be the incentive other than that, or you can't have Lipitor, you have to take the unpronounceable generic equivalent?
I'm honestly not sure I follow your question.
Well, what is the incentive to deny the authorization in the absence of some...
There is none. That's my point. There is no incentive to deny the authorization under normal circumstances. If there is an incentive, it's because of something that has been written by the doctor in the medical records.
My point was, if there's something in the medical record that's being reviewed, a new prescription, let's start from scratch. A new prescription is sought by a claimant. The CompCare hasn't seen that prescription before. It doesn't appear to be related to the work-related injury. It's a prescription for something that doesn't treat that, whatever it may be, injury.
Yes.
Under those circumstances, wouldn't the carrier deny the authorization?
Yes, probably they certainly would, until they got some kind of clarification of the need for that prescription from the doctor.
And the system has built-in scrutiny, because if the private physician who has a presumably profit-making pharmacy as a part of his operation has no incentive to deny a prescription for anything, has actually every incentive to write as many prescriptions as he possibly can if he knows his client is going to fill the prescriptions in his pharmacy.
That's true.
So how does the system police this dilemma?
Well, I think in this case we're policing it by inclusion of the worker compensation system. If you leave it to the doctor, in this case it's Dr. Ballou, you're right. I think if you leave it to Dr. Ballou to simply prescribe every prescription and fill it that he wants to distribute, I think there is going to be abuse in the system. And the policing comes into play by allowing the worker compensation system into the process.
So basically you're saying that there is no built-in conflict. Or if there is, it's no different from the economic conflict that exists even in the private non-comp, non-workers comp conflict.
I think that's true. I really do think that's true. And I'm going to say that the statute supports what my position is here with Express Scripts. What I tried to say previously is that 2323 is the statute that gives the absolute rights to the claimant, and it gives the right to choose doctors because doctors are not fungible. The claimant can perceive one doctor as better than another, and they get the opportunity to treat with who they think is better. One prescription is not better than another. I can go to five pharmacies and buy the same prescription, and I'm going to get jars of the same thing at all five pharmacies. They should not be different. Those things are fungible. And it's possible, Justice Ridgely, that physical therapy falls into that same category. Physical therapy is not treatment by a physician. Physical therapy is treatment recommended by a physician and guided by a physician, but the treatment you get at a physical therapy facility should be fungible. Should be able to go to five different facilities and get similar treatment.
So you're saying the statutory bright line here is between the furnishing of services, medical and related, and drugs?
Yes. And I think it's supported by looking at 2322. When you look at 2322A, that says the employer shall furnish medical treatment, including medicine and supplies. So in that section, they give you the magic words, medicine and supplies. That is not in 2323, and it says unless the employee refuses to allow them to be furnished by the employer. Now, that's the language that Mr. Schmittinger relies on for support of his theory that the claimant has this absolute right to deny whatever the employer provides and go with some other provider.
Well, there's where the connection has to be made by us. It either results in his argument that authorized refusal under 2322A means they can go elsewhere and the employer's nonetheless obligated to reimburse them for the cost of going elsewhere, mm-hmm. or your position, which is it constitutes a forfeiture under 2323 and they lose the right.
That's right.
They're on their own. There's no middle ground here.
I don't know if, as a practical matter, they'd be on their own, to be honest with you, Justice Steele, but I think that is, if you read the statute, the claimant simply does not have the right to go out and get these prescriptions on their own.
Well, they're on their own in the sense that they have to pay out of pocket and then go through the comp system to get reimbursement. Or they have to have some other access to insurance that will make up the difference.
Yes.
Like this, a flex plan where they set aside so much money a year. And I suspect most workers' comp claimants don't have a flex plan.
But my point is Section 2322A just doesn't give them that right. That's not what that language means. The language is a recognition that an employer, it tells an employer that, yes, you have to offer reasonable medical care. And then it says, but employee, you don't have to accept it. We can't force you to get treatment. We can't force you to take medications. We can't force you to go to a doctor or a surgeon or anything. But if you don't do that, then 2353 says if you do something that inhibits your unreasonably inhibits your recovery, then we can take steps to forfeit your benefits. So those two statutes, 2322 and 2353, are brother statutes with the same purpose, and that was acknowledged by this court 40 years ago in 1977, however long that was. Also, 2322B is very important in this case, because if Mr. Schmittinger's argument is correct, that the claimant has an absolute right, then why in 2322B does it say that if an employer refuses to furnish medical treatment, including medicines and supplies, then the employee can procure it themselves? Why is that language in there? Only if the employee refuses to furnish the medicine can the employee go out and get it himself. The trigger is the refusal, and there simply has not been a refusal in this case by any stretch of the imagination. Nobody has challenged the claimant's right to these medications, and in fact, We've said here, get them almost anywhere you want and get them delivered to your home if you want. So if we're talking about furnishing medicines with a claimant who needs them is a bringing together of the two, how much closer together can we bring them than to give them to the claimant through the mail at his or her house? So I think Mr. Schmittinger's argument is just flawed because it's contrary to all these other statutes. It's contrary to 2353. It doesn't take that into account. It's contrary to 2322B. It's contrary to 2323, which specifically sets out those rights which are absolute for the claimant. Let me, if I can, talk about the fee schedule and the health care guidelines. Mr. Schmittinger went into that a little bit. I think those are also very supportive of my position in this case, and I say that because the practice guidelines, 2322 in capital B, which are in the pocket parts of this, acknowledge that an employer can contract for a lower rate with a provider, and that negotiated rate in the contract shall prevail. So the healthcare practice guidelines contemplate exactly what we're doing in this case. If an employee had this absolute right that Mr. Schmittinger is talking about, then what would be the purpose of that language in 2322 capital B? And I distinguish that from lowercase b that's in the other part of the statute. If we assume that every word is in the statute for a reason and not a mistake, then certainly that is evidence that an employer can go out and contract with a private facility, a pharmacy or a service, at a lower rate, even below the treatment guidelines.
So if I understand your position, it is that, number one, the issue before us is just a matter of a straight down-the-line statutory construction, number one.
Sure.
Number two, reading the different sections of the statute that you've alluded to together, they all fit together congruently and make it clear that while there is a right of choice as far as medical services and services related to them, there is no similar right with respect to the furnishing of drugs.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
If the only choice is to accept or decline, but the consequence of a decline is forfeiture.
I think that's true, yes.
And that's the end of the case. Is that correct?
In my mind, it is. Mr. Schmittinger has thrown into the mix this availability of the medicine and saying that there might be a delay, and that's what we talked about earlier in the argument.
But your position is that, the argument, the analysis begins and ends with the text of the statute.
Yes, sir. That's what I believe.
Now, the other side cited the Alabama case. Is that the only other court that's addressed this specific issue?
Justice Ridgely, I'm not sure if that's the only court. That's certainly the only court that we've found that addressed the issue. And I can tell you that the Alabama case is not applicable to this case because their statute is written so that it includes, I believe it includes the word pharmacy in with the definition of physicians and health care providers. So in our case, if it were analogous to our case, I think that would be in, they would say then in 2323, that pharmacies or pharmacists would be included in that section. So I think that's their statute is completely different than ours in a very fundamental way. If I can, just to summarize what I think this case is about and why my position is the accurate one. If it is true that the employee has an absolute right to purchase prescriptions wherever she wants, then why didn't the legislature put those words, including medicine and supplies, in section 2323? And 2323 is the one that I believe gives the claimant certain absolute rights to choose their medical provider. They didn't do that. If the employee is correct that the language of 2322A gives her the right to go out and get prescriptions somewhere else, then why does section 2322B specifically say that the claimant can't go out and get her medicines herself, by way of example, until there's a refusal by the employer? Again, that's an indication that this is not an absolute right to refuse and go out and get your own prescriptions. Why does 2322B in the health care practice section give the employer the right to contract with providers for a lower price, even lower than the fee schedule? If my position weren't accurate, then that language would not be there, and we know we have to give meaning to all of the words of the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Kuzman.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's been a pleasure.
Are you going to answer the last three questions?
I have a few to address. If the court would like to point me in one direction or another, I'll be happy to take direction. I want to point out with respect to the forfeiture statute that it only becomes applicable if the refusal in question, refusal to actually get treatment, results in a worsening of the condition. It's not absolute. It's not a simple matter of if you decline under 2322 to have the employer supply these medicines and you seek to go out on your own. That in and of itself doesn't trigger a forfeiture. So it's not as direct as the employer would have you think.
You read that into the word reasonable?
In the forfeiture?
Yeah.
I think you have to have a worsening of the...
Well, 2353A doesn't use the word worsening. It says refuses reasonable.
Excuse me. The consequences of the worsened condition under the forfeiture statute, and I'm afraid I don't have that language at my fingertips.
Yeah, well, don't worry about it now. Go ahead to the point
you
want to make.
The carrier's contention that they have the right to contract for a lower rate is not the same thing as the right to impose either that lower rate or that provider with whom they've contracted on an injured worker. That's specifically not provided in the statute. Basically, all it says is that if they've contracted for a lower rate with the provider that the claimant has chosen, then the carrier gets the benefit of the lower rate. I think that in and of itself is telling.
It says 2322B also cover medical providers, doctors, chiropractors, or is it just medicines?
The health care payment program, that whether you're talking about the health care advisory panel, you're talking about the fee schedule, you're talking about the practice guidelines, that's intended to govern all of it, all of that medical treatment. I also want to point out that there's an interim state between authorized and denied here, and it's, we don't know. We haven't heard back from the carrier. And that's a state that can persist for a long time. If the carrier doesn't give an authorization, simply doesn't respond.
But again, it's not a matter of fact in this case.
Because of the timing of this case, that's true. I see I'm on a red
light. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.